Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Bravo. Bravo, bravo. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org. The most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which the more I'm around, the more I realize that there's more of it that I don't, that we can't see, but it's there just the same. I like to think that we're spiritual beings having a physical experience, and that spirit, the spirit of everything, is just out of reach for us, but it's still there nevertheless. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this for us as a public service presentation. It works both ways. They're required by the FHA, whatever it is, what is it, the Federal Communication, FCA Communications. Yeah. They have to put so much time into public service. I know Hoyt for a while. He's the station manager. He hasn't taken a day off in 9 years, and he doesn't remember the day that he, before that, he doesn't remember when. He cannot not take a day off. He can't do it. He's tried, but just not able to do that. Insanity is a funny thing. It might be insane to me, but it's perfectly normal and comfortable and all right with him. That's his day. And he's a friend of ours. So we'd like to thank Hoyt and Tony. We would also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. The families are being beset on all sides and all ways. I believe all the trouble we're having with the kids and the guns and all that is because the children are not being taught correct principles. Nobody's home. They're growing up like vacant lot weeds, and they're finding no information, and our society is being beset by this onslaught of behavior, which is it's deleterious to everybody. But part of what we do in Rum Radio is trying to get the message out on recovery. Most crime that I've seen coming around, and I've been around for a while, is drug and alcohol related in some fashion. I think very few happen just because the guy's an entrepreneur and he decided to go that way. But most crimes of passion and opportunity are drug and alcohol motivated. So I believe the family is critical. Harold does a great job. It's a tough job, and most of the time it's a thankless job, but he does fine work. Harold?
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Joseph. This is being on air and talking about working with others is my way of giving back. If people hadn't been, if the 12 steps weren't available and people weren't in the rooms, I'm sure I would have lost my life a long time ago with this disease of addiction. It is a deadly disease if it isn't treated. So people were there for me. I want to be there for others. And so we're on the air with that in mind. And I just want to take a moment to tell our listeners that Joseph does not make money from this adventure. It costs him money to do this. He sunk thousands into the website and the radio program and continues to improve it and invest his own money. So this is a work of love. It's our way of giving back. We really both owe our lives to the program and the 12 steps and the process of people working with each other to stay sober and to stay in recovery. There's a lot more to recovery than just being sober. So it's nice of you listeners to tune in. We also have a chat room now, and I'll let I haven't figured out how to get on it yet, actually, but maybe we'll figure out a way to do that. So I'm looking forward to tonight's program, and I'll turn it back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. We have a special guest tonight, Matthew L. He's the creator of Rowdy Rum, which is one of the Facebook recovery chat phenomenon. People go on there and they discuss recovery in their opinion. If, you know, if you get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. And some of them are really quite passionate. As a member of the program, I could tell you this, I might not be right, but I'm never wrong. And you could take that to the bank. So it's an interesting way of doing that. Before I introduce Matthew and we get started on tonight's program, I'd like to start off with this. It's the third step prayer. It's when I get a new sponsee, and I've asked him the questions, has he had enough? Yes or no? Is he willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? I'm kind of blunt, and this might not work for everybody, but it works for me because of my personality, and that's normally what attracts the sponsee-sponsor relationship is the connection, and that's usually it. But I think that it doesn't really matter. If you're willing to do it and your sponsor says it's okay, then you're going to have to take that leap of faith. I put it on the website. The jumping frog of Calaveras County has buckshot in the rump and takes a leap of faith anyway. So sometimes you just have to go out there and start the process. But Rum Radio is about having the tools necessary to have a good chance of accomplishing that end, which is intensive work with another alcoholic. We find this activity to work when other activities fail. And the first assignment I give them, once I use Clancy's seven questions, I carry that around with me when I'm looking for a sponsee. Page 89 of the big book says, go out and find a prospect and start working on them. And I do that because that's what it says in the book. And I carry Clancy's seven questions. Clancy I is a pillar in the AA community, and he has some really great stuff. Usually with Clancy, you either love him or you hate him. But Clancy's outspoken, and he has a really great program. I've been dissed from him a couple times. And the seven questions, I hand them. It's already printed out. I believe when preparation meets opportunity, it's called luck. So if I'm prepared, the ability to sponsor somebody will be made available. I give him the questions, say, okay, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit. But there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I need you to do is answer these seven questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call. If I get the call and he's done the work, he's taken a simple instruction, and he's demonstrated to me that he's willing to go at least to that length. And I'm willing to put in much effort in his recovery as he is on his own, for his own recovery, no more, no less. And if I get those back, one of the first assignments I give them is to get a newcomer's packet or a list of men, 20 or 30 if possible, from his designated home group. Find a home group and get these names, they're the lifeline names. And every day for the next 30 days, I want you to call a different man every day on that list and ask him permission to recite the third step prayer to him. And I do this for a particular reason. It gets him used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. It connects him up with his home group. He gets to know their name. They get to know his name. Third, the third step prayer is also called a surrender prayer. It encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, the person he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol, and chances are, no guarantee, that he won't, so your sponsee's already in service work, which we find to be the most productive way of attaining and maintaining long-term sobriety in AA. This is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Amen.
That's Carmen. Carmen, say hello, Carmen. Carmen's working our chat room board. You doing all right tonight, Carmen?
I am doing wonderful tonight. Good night. Good evening, everybody. I just there's currently 16 people in the chat room, and I do have questions to post. So as we go along, I will ask questions of Matthew and relay it back to the people in the chat room.
Great, Carmen. Thank you so much for your service.
You're welcome, Joseph.
Okay. Okay. Matthew L. is the creator of this Rowdy Rum. He's very provocative in his postings. He likes to stir the pot. And I believe this is really AA. That's why I like Rowdy Rum. AA is a fellowship of free thinkers. We're a group of entrepreneurs and self-promoters. And we're free thinkers. There's no doubt about it. What I've seen, I don't know if anybody else would, any non-alcoholic would say that, but I see that when we're in the rooms where there is no police, where whatever we want to talk, think, or say is okay in AA. We let God take care of the rest of it. And I believe that works, and it works really well when we follow the traditions in that suggestion. So, Matthew, tell us, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, real good. Thank you. And so glad that you can make it onto the show. Usually, you're welcome. The way we do this is on a chat format. But basically, what we'd like to do is find out what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, your passion to stay sober, how you attain and maintain sobriety, long-term sobriety. There's a lot of folks out there struggling. They don't believe that this would work. And my sponsor told me one time, hey, if it works for a jerk like you, it can work for anybody.
That is most certainly true in my case. So,
but tell us, when was the first time that you realized that you enjoyed the elixir of alcohol?
Well, I drank fairly heavy during the college years. I was one of those guys that really didn't start drinking until I was about 20 years old. And actually, I had discovered pot and acid and all that stuff way before alcohol. I actually thought originally that alcohol was for losers, drugs were for cool people. And so while I was in high school, I didn't drink, but I just, you know, I smoked a whole lot of pot and I did a whole lot of acid. And then finally, when I was in college, it was, oh my God, this alcohol stuff really can mess you up, and it can do it so much faster and so much cheaper, you know, than this other stuff. So I really pounded it out for quite a few years, and then I found out, I discovered this wonderful thing called cocaine when I was about 24, and the combination of the two just really took off in just a fabulous way. You know, I became a multimillionaire by the time I was 25. That part's a lie. Things went downhill real fast. And so my thing was, see, I got onto the drug scene, and particularly for cocaine, so fast that I really didn't have time to see any damage of life from alcohol as much as I did from the cocaine. I can tell you this, though. I have experienced this phenomenon of craving. I do know what it's like where you tell your girlfriend or your wife, I'll be home by 6 o'clock, and you're closing the bar at 3 in the morning. In fact, it's never been a case when I didn't do that. So, I do know what it is to identify with somebody who says, I can't stop. I just have yet to ever experience so much damage in my life, particularly from alcohol alone, because the cocaine always took over. And by the time, you know, it was 12 or 2 in the morning, hey, let's go to an after-hour party, and the cocaine was on the table, and then I'm gone for 3, 4, 5 days, you know, just doing that. And it's my experience and my observation that that is the case with a lot of people that come in young. I came in AA very young, and I felt that originally –
I felt that my problem was cocaine alone. And I attempted to successfully drink alcohol. And miraculously, the darn stuff always seems to lead me right back. So I have a tendency to break out in eight balls every time I drink alcohol. Whether or not you want to consider that a true alcoholic, I don't know. I can tell you that every time I put alcohol to my lips, there's sufficient damage that has been done to my life.
It sounds alcoholic to me. Whatever that might be. Alcohol is a symptom of the disease, and I believe the substance is sort of a secondary consideration by the time you get to that point. That's for me. You find that true?
I do. I think that I really do. And I hope and I expect that there are going to be a lot of people on the call that are going to say, you're not really an alcoholic and that stuff. And I'll be happy to entertain those questions. There is something that we have to keep in mind, though, and that is what the big book says that really binds us and unites us together is not the problem of alcohol. That is just one of the many things. But the main thing the book says is that the solution is what unites us, and that is the most important thing. And for some
Absolutely,
reason,
that,
it's, yeah.
That's really and, great and, to and, hear. This is Harold.
Yeah.
I just wanted to interject that I rarely use the word alcoholic anymore, and I really find what was valuable for me is the word dependent. I was dependent substances, and that's really created the biggest problem. You know, my first sponsor said, did you notice that not every time you drink do you get in trouble, but every single time you've been in trouble, it was either alcohol or drugs. Yeah. Joseph?
Yeah, I kind of noticed that.
Can I just run off on that real quick and say that this is something that a good friend of mine, Elaine B., who's on the Rowdy Rum, constantly reminds people that the term alcoholic, recovered alcoholic, recovering alcoholic, and we can avoid that whole controversy if we do just what Bill Wilson said, was that he always introduced himself as member. That he's a member of AA. And so we end up, you know, just avoiding all that. Because if you really get down to it, there is no scientific way to actually identify who is an alcoholic, with the exception that if you took the 12 steps in AA, they worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. I was going to say I was with my two daughters today. My one daughter was in the hospital for a back operation. She's doing a lot well now, a lot better. And my other daughter, who has this thing with me, I got her to forgive me. I tricked her into forgiving me, and so it went really well. But she insisted, Dad, you're not an alcoholic. You know, and she even alluded to the fact that, you know, this is really hypocrisy because you're really not an alcoholic and you're doing the website and you're doing this. And so the only way I could tell her, I says, you know, Libby, you could be right.
Right? Yeah. Hey, I was sent to AA. It seemed to work. So let's just, you know, that's going to be what we're going to go with. So,
Carmen, was there any questions you wanted to pose to Matthew? Was there anything that jumped out at you?
We have a recurring question here, and specifically by Susan, who wanted to know if Matthew identified as an alcoholic. He has talked about it, but because she specifically asked that question, I'd like to pose that to him.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. It depends on really how you're defining what is an alcoholic. In terms of somebody that identifies that they have no control over a substance, that when they imbibe something, that it just goes right to the very core of them and they become someone else, that they destroy their own life, absolutely. If you're talking about a particular particular reaction to that particular chemical, my honest answer is I don't know. I have had an experience. I have experienced the phenomenon of craving. I know that to be true, but it was headed off during my life with a bunch of eight balls and cocaine, and I was actually unable to know if alcohol would have ever progressed to that point without the coke. It feels to me, based on the way that I drank when I was younger, that that is the truth, yes.
Well, good. Thank you, Matthew.
So now what happened, Matthew? Okay, so you're in college. How'd you do in college? I take it you're an educated man. You have a master's, right? And you're a mathematician?
I do. I have a master's degree in statistics, and I'm currently working for a wonderful organization, one of the largest corporations in the world, and certainly currently getting my actuarial license, and it's been a real blessing. It's been an amazing, amazing journey because at the beginning of my trip in sobriety and through the spiritual experience, I was homeless. And to be finding myself now making over $100,000 a year and living in a luxury apartment is something that, you know, still is making my head spin.
What was your jumping off point? Okay, so we're in college and you're doing eight balls like there's no tomorrow, but you're keeping your grades up, I take it, right? You're still keeping your grades up?
Well, no, my first attempt at college, I bombed out completely. I went to East Carolina University. And I actually majored in acting, and that was between the ages of 18 and 21. And I attended for 2.5 years, and then I got into the coke and decided that selling and doing coke was more important than actually doing the work. And I had issues with my father, and he stopped paying for the college. And I was actually kind of left in this oasis in this small town in the middle of nowhere with no experience as to how to take care of my own life. I didn't even know at that point that you could apply for loans, and I think I was actually too young at that point to be able to do that independently anyway. So I ended up going into a few years of trying to do acting. I moved up to New York City, had a wonderful experience with heroin up there for about 6 months. It didn't work out too well. And it was interesting because that was actually something that I tried, never shot up, but I snorted it, and it was never something that really stuck. The withdrawal from heroin was so bad that I never wanted to touch it again. So I ended up moving back down to North Carolina. I tried to do some acting down there, got involved in more drugs, more alcohol, and things just, I couldn't see it, but they just kept spiraling downhill the more I tried to gain control. Somehow I was going to make this thing all work. I was lonely. I had no friends. I was absolutely just in despair of who I was. And about 25 years old, I started to become suicidal. And I had been kicked out of my fiance's apartment. She was making a lot of money, and she had had enough of me. And I ended up in this temporary house. It was kind of like just a place where you rented a room out. And I met another guy there who introduced me to a much more potent form of cocaine. And it ended up just between that and today. And let me add something to some of the naysayers who may say he's not really an alcoholic. It is interesting that I'll add that every time that I drank after 25 years old, when I started to, the only thing that would really get me drunk was vodka. I get sick over beer, I get sick over wine, but I've got to have that hardcore liquor. And I'll drink the whole bottle, no problem. I could probably drink. I've drank a fifth, no problem. I've drank, I remember Everclear was a great, you know, anything that was just a white liquor or brown liquor was really my thing. I never just wanted to take something that was weak. For some reason, my body just couldn't take it very well. Didn't imbibe it fast enough. And when I had been thrown out and I had been introduced to this new form of cocaine and we were flying through the city and just started to steal things and we were mugging people and I mean, it got to be this complete, absolute mess. This guy eventually left the house. He couldn't take it anymore because I was so out of control. By his standards, I was out of control. And I literally was starting to, you know how alcoholics say the prayer, please God help me. Well, I was beyond that. Yeah,
prayer and medication.
I was beyond that. Yeah. I tell people, you don't know what it's like until you start saying the prayer, please God kill me. When you're there, you're at a point of jumping off. And it's really funny because it was just me in that house by myself. And the drug dealer would come by every 5, you know, every 10 minutes or whatever. He just got sick of how much I kept calling him. And finally, one time, he walked in the house, and he said, come on, man, we're going to go take a ride somewhere. And he stuck me in the car, and we drove downtown Cincinnati, and he dropped me off at the detox center and said, get the hell out and never call me again. I said, what are you doing, man? I said, I'm making you money. He says, this shit sells itself. I ain't going to have a dead white boy in my hands. Now, get the hell in there. My first drug dealer in Cincinnati took me to detox. That's how bad I was.
He loved you.
Yes,
he cared about you. He liked you. In spite of the money he was making off your butt, he liked you and he didn't want to see you die and he didn't want to feel responsible for your death.
Yeah.
But he could see the Grim Reaper over your head.
Isn't that something?
Don't want to lose a customer either.
Yeah, I know, right? But there was several years after that, but that was when I was formally introduced to AA. I was about 26 years old, and I went through a series of going through these rehabs and halfway houses, continually relapsing every 3 to 6 months, could not stay sober. And I'm going to add something to that. And I really, this is a part of the story that really people get upset with. And I don't know why, but it seems that my view of my experience really seems to upset a lot of people. When I walked into AA in the first time, I had my face beaten in. This was after the detox. They told me to go to the Oak Street Club Center, which is in Cincinnati. And I had relapsed after that at some point. I never even made it to the detox, I mean to the clubhouse. But after that point, I had decided, okay, maybe I need to go on my own. And I had my face beaten in because I owed this guy money. And I walk into the clubhouse, and I sit down there in a chair, and there's this guy, John N., that sits next to me. And he realizes, with my big fat face and my big fat lip, that this is probably my first meeting. And so he asked me and starts talking to me and starts having a discussion as a sponsor and wants to take me through these things called the steps. And he introduces me to some concepts that never quite sat right with me. And I started hearing things in AA that in my heart I knew weren't true, but I just could never get a footing onto actually finding that it wasn't true until I started really reading the big book. And there is a region, and for some reason, that Ohio Valley region is so rehab saturated that their view of what is AA is just centrally focused on this idea of powerlessness. And that you have to give your whole life up, that you are, and I wanted to talk to you about, you know, your view with Clancy and how much you respect him. I met Clancy. I like the guy personally. I fundamentally 100% disagree with what Clancy has done for AA. I think that his view of this authoritarian sponsorship is changing. He was one of the front guys that changed the idea from recovered to recovering because he felt that I understand why he did it. I know what he went through, and when he was in the 50s and 60s, and where he saw people that were relapsing, and he said, there's no such thing as recovered. I understand that. But what really felt like AA has become was it degraded into an idea that there is no hope, that all you are is an alcoholic. You'll always be an alcoholic. Your alcoholic mind is always sitting there kicking your ass. And if you don't find someone to tell you what to do and tell you how to live your life, you're going to relapse. And this becomes a program about perpetual fear. It's not a program of hope. It's not a program of, my God, you know, I can start to rely on my instincts again, like it talks about in the book. And this is something that never sat with me since the first meeting. And I had gone through these meetings where people saying, well, you have to rely on meetings to get sober. You have to practice powerlessness to get sober. You have to practice acceptance to get sober. You know, we have to do whatever our sponsor tells us to do without question, because if we don't, we will relapse.
I don't see that in AA. I don't see that.
I don't know. Right. But 90% of the meetings, you will hear that message at least once. One of the most popular sayings, I'm sure you know, in AA, is when people say, well, I can't trust my own mind. Never go into your mind by yourself. You know?
Yeah, the dangerous neighborhood mind.
Right, yeah, and all that junk, right? So you have this notion that somehow you're going to be fighting for your life for the rest of your life, and you can turn around tomorrow and the Grim Reaper is waiting for you on the corner. And this was the message that had been passed on to me through this sponsor and several other sponsors. And, you know, it's no wonder that I kept relapsing. I was encouraged not to read the book, that the book is a bit antiquated.
Brother.
We do it by spouse. Oh, yeah. We're going to do sponsorship this way. My first inventory was 37 pages of straight written dialogue, no columns.
Oh, gosh. How long was the fifth step?
Right. He got sick of it, honestly. About like 3 hours through, he says, okay, that's good. And then he said, and that was it. So keep in mind, too.
I agree with you. That's not AA. That really isn't. It's a shame that we've devolved. That's why one of the reasons I put together Rum Radio, it's more big book than 12 and 12, the way it's set up. It's not set up. It's about agency or free will. Make a suggestion to your sponsee. A suggestion is nothing more than a subtle command. That's agreed, but it's still up to them. I'll tell my sponsees, I'll put in as much effort as you do. I don't chase them. I set out a program that's timely, and we work the steps as outlined in the big book. And I find the timely through the big book and the 12 and 12 works the best. And that's it. And get them into the trenches, working with the next sufferer as quickly as possible because of the immunity. All the rest of this stuff has come from the rehabs. I had one sponsee, and I'll tell you this. I had one sponsee from New Jersey, and he was a chronic relapser, a Joe Hazelton type. He was a ship's captain of the oil tankers. And in his group in New Jersey, they required you to go to meetings for a year before you could work the steps. I told people that, and they go, what? They get mad at me for telling you that. But that's how some of the stuff has been so diluted and so convoluted. I don't understand it. Carmen, do you have another question for Matthew?
Actually, I do. It's a little bit off topic here. I'm gonna actually hold that one back just for a little bit. I'm gonna let Matthew continue because I don't want to pull him off this topic right now.
Okay, great, sure. Okay. Matthew, go ahead. Tell us. So you're at you've made your jumping off point. You've gone to the meeting. The meeting doesn't seem like this is gonna be happening for you. Uh-oh. We all go in and go, I don't know if this is for me. I know when I first came in, I go, I don't see this happening here, but okay. So now you're now this ain't working. Now what?
Right, right. So, and I want to talk about just one of my big inspirations. This, I absolutely love this guy. Today I disagree a little bit with his approach to sponsorship, but in general, his view of what is AA is just, I absolutely agree. I see why he feels that way 100%, and that's Chris Raymer. This very, very controversial figure. And one of the things that he talks about in his leads is he says, I went to meetings for 8 years and almost died. And that really, you know, I'll stretch that out to 10. I started going to meetings when I was in the year 2000. I did not get any actual spiritual relief from alcoholism until 2010. And it is a miracle that I managed to survive that. I have no idea how. Putting cocaine in my body for 10 years straight.
Wow.
Yeah.
The problem I find with that is if you really want to get sober, it doesn't really matter what the sponsor does or doesn't do. You're going to tough it out with whatever program they throw at you because you want it that bad. The problem is when you go to give it back and you don't have a clue what to do, now you're stuck with the same rhetoric again. Hopefully the guy wants it as much as you. Bill W. said, good sponsorship can mean the difference between life and death. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, no, I agree with that to a certain extent. I think that, you know, the first 100 deliberately, and, you know, we of course use that phrase loosely, deliberately came up with a program that seemed to work best. And I can work any program I want. Heck, you know, there I actually did have a span of dryness, of sobriety, during the times of, it was like 2003 to 2007, I managed to maintain drinking successfully for 4 years because I had been driven to a goal, which was getting a degree. And just like the man with the slippers, I was able to stay off the stuff that killed me. Now, I will say that I had missed several exams, and I did not show up for classes, and I almost failed out of school, and all the stuff that Bill Wilson talks about. But at the end there, I actually put down the bottle for the last 2 years of my undergrad and really stuck to it, and I went through it dry. When I finally went through my master's degree, which was another 2 years, the what ended up happening was I remember this so it was just one of the most craziest times. When you're in school for so long and you are staring down the barrel of actually having to get a job, that can be a really, really scary thing because you don't know what that world is like out there. And I actually know a man where that fear of having to leave college ended up that he went he did something really stupid, and he's now serving 10 years over it rather than having a PhD. For me, I barely managed to finish going to classes the last semester just to get that master's. I was getting high. I was getting high while I was teaching classes as a TA. I was drinking like a fish because I couldn't handle it. And everything just went to a straight dive bomb. And and 3 weeks, 3 weeks after managing to graduate from the University of Kentucky, I ended up homeless.
That's really?
Well, that point, yes. never mind getting a job. I couldn't even keep an apartment. So here I was, the most educated homeless person you could find probably on UK campus.
I've met some really educated folks out there, people that would really shock and surprise you. I like to think that there's two alcoholics underneath an overpass, and one guy's, you know, complaining. He says, you know, I used to be somebody. I was an attorney, had a big house, beautiful wife, car, member of the community, and now I'm living in a Lady Kenmore cardboard box. And the other alcoholic turns around and says, wow, man, you got a box?
It's so true. It's so true. I've been to places like the Healing Place, which is a homeless shelter in Louisville. I've been to several more halfway houses that I can count. I really did struggle with this thing for several years. The only relief I ever got, again, was that two-year reprieve when I had determined that nothing was going to stop me from getting that degree. And, of course, like I said, staring down the barrel of that coming to an end, I just couldn't handle it. Things had dive bombed to a point where I wasn't interested in living anymore, period. I was completely suicidal. I had no solution, and I was sick of going to meetings. I thought they were all full of crap, that everybody had said something was absolute garbage, that these people were just inventing this boogeyman that was just going to keep them, you know, barely sober and miserable for the rest of their life. And I really was unable to see the people that had hit a true spirituality, because at that point, for so long, I had tried to go to meetings, I failed, I went, you know, and I kept coming in and out and in and out for so long that I built up a tremendous resentment against AA. And there was no way that anyone was going to sponsor me, ever. And actually, that was back with the turning point of all that came in 2009. And that was actually when I was down in Houston and just visiting the Post Oak Club at that point, which I think is something that you're familiar with, Joseph.
Yeah, we met there.
Yes, we did. And that was when things were just, yes, it is a small world, just amazing. So let me stop at that point because I want to, before I actually hit what I consider to be my spiritual experience, I do want to find out if anybody's got any
questions.
Sure. I guess that'd be a good point to pause.
Yeah, that's a good, yes. Carmen, anything that you find that would be pertinent, enlivening? What do you got?
You want to know? I'm just going to ask this question because it was asked a little bit earlier, and I guess a lot of the people that are currently in the chat room are members of the Rowdy Realm. So the biggest question so far, Matthew, is they want to know if the questions that you post there, if you believe that, if you believe those questions. I'm going to just put that out there now and get it out of the way.
Surely you can.
50% of them.
You had to know that that was going to be asked, Matthew.
Yeah. Yes, it was. That's great. I honestly sit in front of the computer about 50% of the time and go, let's see what happens when we push this button.
Okay, well, there you go. Now they know.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
You know
they
do
it all along. They still react to it. It's fantastic.
You know how you stop someone from getting your goat?
Yes. No. It has nothing to do with the messenger. It's the message that drives them crazy. That's what's so wonderful about it.
You don't tell them where you tied it. So they want to know,
right.
is this guy really that nuts? Is this really him?
Actually, if I could, I have one more question that I'd like to ask you, Matthew, and it's from Bob K. He wants to know,
Bob.
Do you think the book instructions are clear-cut? And if so, why so much debate among intelligent people?
I absolutely love Bob. okay, this is what I think about it. I think that if we were sitting in 1939, those instructions are very clear-cut, and it would read like a simple magazine. I think that we have gone so far from that vocabulary. Bill Wilson was an extremely educated man. He was primarily selling this book to people he thought would be of his level, and unless you are well-versed, it can be a real struggle. And a lot of people that come into AA aren't able to read at that level. And so, unfortunately, today, it does... Oh God, I hate to say this. Bob, damn you. Unfortunately, today, if there was a way to have a perfect translation of what Bill Wilson was trying to convey in 1939, I would be in favor of a rewrite.
I've heard other people say that's kind of like sacrilege. I try to explain to people that the big book is not scripture. This is a spiritually enlivened work based on scripture.
Yeah.
So you can't take everything. Yeah, you know, you gotta, and how you know it's spiritual is because as you grow spiritually, the understanding in the book will also manifest itself in different understandings. But when you first come in the room, most folks, if you're like me, I was spiritually bankrupt. So reading the big book was like, what is this? What are they talking about? How clear-cut is this? You got to be kidding me. You want to hide something from an alcoholic, you put it in the big book. Go ahead, Matt.
Right. So there's, you know, there are a few problems with the idea of a rewrite. For one thing, we have to remember that would be like trying to rewrite Mozart or trying to rewrite, you know, Shakespeare. Who here is good enough to be able to recopy that kind of inspiration?
Good point.
Certainly not me, you know. He had this moment, this white flash of brilliance when he put that book together, and it just can't be replicated. So I think we're kind of stuck with what we have. If we could somehow translate those ideas, those really profound, deep concepts, into something that we could talk about in a language today, I would be 100% in favor of it. But the concepts have already been lost so badly that I wouldn't trust anybody to write it, really. Maybe John
Lee.
Yeah,
John probably could, if anybody.
Yeah.
I think the key would be, it's not really up to the new the new man to translate what's in the big book. It's up to his sponsor to get him to the fine points in the book and get him through the steps. And as man grows spiritually, or the woman grows spiritually, more shall be revealed. More shall be disclosed. The word is disclosed, not revealed, but we always use reveal. More shall be disclosed to both you and to us spiritually. This is a spiritual understanding. The 12th step is all what it's all about. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result, the one result we're trying to get from working all 12 steps from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the one result, is to grow spiritually into a position of awakening. But that's not going to happen overnight. Time takes time. So sponsorship really is the key to direct that understanding. Someone who's got a little time, that's been through correctly through the big book, now the new man has a chance to comprehend what's going to save his life.
Actually, we have another question regarding the spiritual experience, and it's coming from Alan. He wants to know if you've had a spiritual experience.
I did. I've had a very profound one, and I can't share that point. I want to get to that in just a second.
Okay.
So if you can imagine that I had, at this point, by the end of 2010, towards the end of 2010, I had been dragged through the mud, and I was absolutely done with life. I wasn't done with drinking. I was done with life. I had lost everything. The only things I had left was a car and a trash bag full of my clothes. And I had ran away from Houston because I had another relapse down there. And I traveled up back to Louisville, and my best friend, Todd B., said, Matt, why don't you just clean yourself up, and you can stay with me for a couple weeks until you figure out what you're going to do. I'm forever grateful to that man for what he did. I came on his couch, and he had gone to work the next day, and that morning I sat up on that couch with nothing. My life, everything I had tried to accomplish, everything that I wanted, I was 36 years old, and I had nothing to speak for. No wife, no house, no career. Everything was gone. And I Todd had required that I actually go to AA. At that point, I was done with it. He said, if you want to, you know, live in this house, you gotta go. And I was tired of saying the prayer, God, please kill me. And there was Todd's big book sitting on the table, over on the table to the right of the sofa where he used to keep all his stuff. And I said, I just hate this program. I absolutely hate the powerlessness of this program, what they're teaching us. And I said to myself, God, what if this program was about power? I said, I'm going to open this book up right now, and I'm going to start reading it. And if this program is about power, you show me. And the freaking thing lit up like a Christmas tree.
Wow.
All of a sudden, the phrases in the book, everything started to make sense. I mean, it all just started coming together like a puzzle piece. And you're going, wait a second, I didn't learn that. I didn't hear that. This is not what he said. And you're going, wait a second, this is a completely different message. That's my spiritual experience.
The prayer of the agnostic.
Yeah, page 45.
Yeah.
The righteous.
Yeah.
It said, evil and adulterous generation that seeks after a sign. And, of course, the atheist has nobody to ask. But the agnostic has got an open channel. If you want to know if there's God, just ask him.
That's something.
Actually, Matthew, I would like to actually ask you another question, and it does come from Todd B. He's in the chat room right now. He's asked me to ask you that he goes, I know in his earlier years that he always thought there had to be another way other than AA, and has his opinion changed and why?
That is wonderful.
And that's from Todd.
God bless Todd. when I was in Houston, I had rejected AA. I did Smart Recovery for about 2 years. I think it is a great program for people who need to dry up, and it works very well in the short term. I do not think that it lasts very well in the long term. There is nothing that is equivalent to having long-term sobriety like AA. If you can get through those first years, it is questionable how effective it is in the first year. But in terms of, because of, you know, whether or not you're actually going to take the steps as prescribed. But once you get to a certain point, there is nothing that comes close to AA in terms of long-term sobriety.
I agree. We got a caller, Matthew. Let me take this call, see what they... Hello, caller. I know you've waited for a while. You're on the air. You there? 502-408-2364. Anybody home? Going once. Going twice.
Hello?
Oh, there he is. Yes.
Hello?
Yeah, who is this?
Yeah, my name's
on the air.
John Michael, I'm an alcoholic, recovered alcoholic.
You hear me? Have a question?
Yeah, I did. Actually, I was just sitting around listening in, then you said my phone number. I'm like, yeah, great. Yeah, I just had a question for Matthew Lecter. Matthew L. No, my bad. Yeah, throw him out there. Yeah, I had a question on the powerless jag. See, for a long time, man, people would always constantly bombard this powerlessness over people, places, and things. And, you know, I had a real hard time accepting that. I started looking around and realized I had the ability to change the ideas around me. I had the ability to either cause, you know, help or harm in the places that I was recovering in. And I just have a hard time believing that I am powerless over people, places, and things. I might be powerless over alcohol under the idea that if I put any substance in my body, I will be right back where I started with an unmanageable and drunk. But when it comes to my fellows and this camaraderie, this fellowship, I am not powerless. A sense of empowerment, almost when if I were to walk into a meeting, raise my hand and say anything, I have the ability to change the hearts of the people around me. And,
what's your question, though? You're making a statement. Do you have a question?
Yeah, my question was for Matthew. He was talking about powerlessness earlier, about how that's what they were asking. My question was going to be, when they introduced the idea of powerlessness to you, what was your exact reaction, knowing that you had these degrees, that you were in school and doing these things that you needed to be doing, but... how did you react to the powerlessness idea?
Well, I believe I had addressed that back in the beginning of the story. That was originally introduced to me back in the year 2000 with, you know, just the concept of having to go to meetings and I need a meeting and people relapse who don't go to meetings and all that crap. And what I had discovered with my experience with this big book, when I was sitting down on Todd Bozeman's couch, was that the exact opposite message is true. And if you actually read the very last promise in the book, which a lot of people seem to miss, is that great events will occur for you and countless others. What is the condition upon which those great events will occur for you and countless others? That condition is that your house is in order. So if your house is in order, you are affecting great events. You are causing great events to occur for other people. And that is one of the many examples. You know, it says in the big book, we have recovered and have been given the power to help others. That shoots down powerless over people, places, and things right there. There's a whole section in Chapter 7 where it talks about we can go to sordid places. That shoots down the whole powerless over places right there. You know, in terms of things, I think, you know, we could even call alcohol a thing. And really, we were powerless until we had called upon a higher power to solve our problem for us. And then the drink problem has been solved. So I think, you know, 1, 2, 3, powerless over people, places, and things, does not exist for somebody who is truly working the program of AA. And I want to let me drive this a little bit home. I'm a guy who had chronically relapsed over and over and over again for years because of a message of powerlessness, because of a message of I must be weak and I must be accepting of all things, and we have to go to meetings all the time. And I mean, just there is absolute dread in so many of these meetings where you show up, you're looking for a cheerleading squad for God, and you get a freaking group therapy session where people talk about 5, 6, 10 years sober, how much they hate their life. I remember once, you know, and it's like, I don't want this. You know, who would possibly want that? And nothing pisses me off more than an old-timer that's sitting in a meeting with 10 or 20 years talking about how his life sucks. That is the most selfish damn thing you can ever do to a newcomer. Shut up, because it really doesn't help anybody. You got a sponsor for that. You got inventory for that. You got amends for that. Don't bring your crap to a meeting so a newcomer can hear how fucked up your life is. I'm sorry, I said I wasn't going to use that word. You got me rolling.
Well, I tell some of the folks who do that, you know, if that works for you, that's great, but we have children in the room of all ages, and try to watch what you're saying to encourage. We're here to encourage the new guy, not to tell him how bad things are. That's not necessary. But, you know, AA is AA, and until things change, things are not going to change.
Joseph. See, that's the thing, is until we actually pick up the arms and start saying that we are the change, until we start saying that we are the ones that can change it, we have to change this thing. Go on the website of AA and you'll see a whole excerpt there about the responsibility clause. It is up to us. God's not going to change this. He's going to put the inspiration in us to change it. We have to do this. Because people die over this. They really do. People come into these rooms, hear this powerlessness crap, and say, I would rather die than have to live like that. And that, I've seen it over and over and over again, and it rips my heart out.
Yeah, people are dying, and that's because we've gotten into a spin-dry cycle. That's what we're trying to do, to get out of the spin-dry and the revolving door. So tell us, you had the burning book experience. Now what?
I did. Well, I actually I went on the tirade, you know, exactly what you just heard, that I had literally felt like I had memorized the book in a week. I mean, the phrases and the sayings became so just sudden in my head. I started quoting the Big Book in meetings, and I even started, you know, I started saying, "No, you're wrong, and you're killing people," and I got banned from meetings for that. I was so angry. I was so passionate about this Big Book that I got banned from 3-4 clubhouses. There's actually a speaker meeting with me at the Pigeon Roost where I gave a talk, and I actually hadn't even warmed up yet, but Debbie Messina had decided to take me off the stage 8 minutes into the talk. It was lovely. There is a sentiment in AA that if you know, they talk about open-mindedness, but what they really want is the newcomer to be open-minded to their ideas. They themselves are terrified to be open-minded. If you actually look and analyze and question your own beliefs, which is what I had to do, and say, is this really what AA was saying? Is it? Is what I have been taught truly AA? Is it the real message that Bill Wilson wrote? And 90% of what you hear in meetings, the answer will be no.
How sad. Isn't that sad?
Yeah, it is. You know, one of the things that I give you an example of, and John Lee, before he, you know, he would correct me on this, say, well, capitulated is mentioned in the book. The word surrender is not in the Big Book. It is one of the most popular topics in AA meetings. It's not even mentioned. It's not mentioned. Where did
you
we
sure?
get to a point?
I've heard it so
yes,
often.
It's not in the Big Book.
I would swear it was in there.
Yeah, you would think. Do you know what is in there, though? If you read Bill Wilson's story, the word victory, which is the opposite of surrender, is in there 4 times. And in fact, if you look at Bill Wilson's spiritual experience, you will see he says there the moment he had his spiritual experience, he said there was a sense of victory. why the hell don't we have victory as topics? Have you ever been to a meeting when victory has been the topic of an AA meeting?
Never.
Never. No wonder we're screwed up.
Never.
You know,
it's always,
Bill
it's
Wilson,
always the problem. We hear most of the time it's the problem. We don't hear the solution. Very rare.
Yeah.
I tell my my sponsees when I go through my sponsees, I say, look, no sharing until you work step five. And that's because at step five, not only can you talk to the solution, but I use the pain that they have initially to get them through the steps in a timely manner. So now they can talk at five.
Yes.
And the important thing is not, and remember when you do share that there's 12 steps, only one step mentions the problem. The other 11 steps, so 11 twelfths of the program is the solution. We live in the solution, not in the problem. But some folks don't get that. They got to stay, you know, because they have a perfect step one. And they've got a polish where it glints in the sun, and that's where they're going.
Whatever that means, what exactly does that mean? I love when people say, I need to practice humility. Okay, do it. Show me what that is. Do that right now. And they go, practice acceptance. Do that right now. Show me what that is.
How do you spell relief, right?
But anybody who says practice accept, I just need to practice acceptance, what they're really saying is, I don't want to do any work. That's all they're saying.
good point. So now what happens? Okay, so now you got the big book. You're a big book thumper.
I'm thumping away. There was a group in Louisville, and it's a very influential group in Louisville, named Sicker Than Most, and they really embraced this idea of the powerlessness acceptance thing. Bert W. is a member of this group, and he actually is a very, very influential member of Louisville AA, and kudos to him for that. And so that group really was very much affected because we kind of frequented a lot of the same meetings, and I had met and had several confrontations with a lot of those people who said, you cannot talk about power. You cannot talk about questioning your sponsor. You cannot talk about just reading the book. You know, because these things are dangerous and they kill newcomers. And then I'm going, no, you're dangerous if you're killing newcomers. And
oh,
so
they don't want to hear that.
Right. And that didn't go well. So I was banned from several meetings, and there was this big online group that they have, and they still have today. And I do not recommend really anybody goes in there. It's basically a porn site at this point. But what they do is they talk about really sick things. And there is a view from them, as is from probably the majority of AA, that we can't get any better than this. This is as good as it gets. And that's the tragedy, you know, is that when Bill Wilson is talking about the fourth dimension of existence, and these guys are talking about this is as good as it gets and I just need to accept where I am, you've gone off the wrong track, buddy. And so they kicked me out of that group. The group, mind you, is called Sicker Than Most. And I had decided that I was going to start a group that was literally at the time it was, a reactionary group to that message. And that group was called Recovered Unlike Most. And Todd B. had noticed that the initials of that group were RUM. And so as the group started to accumulate, and what I did was I decided that I was going to set up a group where people could literally come in and talk about the topics that they're afraid to talk about, the things that nobody really can say. They're terrified to say. They're terrified to question. We want them to question. We want them to get in there and get into the nitty-gritty. Your faith is only deepened if you actually find that it can be questioned and you're still standing there. And so we started conducting these debates about what is recovered versus recovering. What does the big book say on this topic? How should a fourth step be done? And you have, you know, tons of very, very you know, in some cases, well-named personalities in there and very passionate, strong individuals with great ideas. And they're coming at each other, and they're saying, no, you do it this way, no, you do it this way, you know. And the thing just started to work because most of the Facebook groups are about, you know, puppies and little children and talking about, oh, hey, I got 3 days sober today, and everybody cheers. We had a group where it was entirely different, where we were actually going at it and talking about what the heck was this message, what was it about. And the thing in a year blew up to I think it's about at 2,500 members now, and it's one of the most popular and frequenting groups on Facebook, and I'm really, really happy to see how well it has taken off. And beyond that, my own life, by finding this determination and having that particular, this newfound method of sobriety, this big book, this type of big book, though, this one where it really talks about the recovered type of view, where we have overcome this thing, and it's not about surrendering, but it's about the fact that we were defeated, and then we called in for reinforcements in this war, you know. And I met a guy named Cameron Freeman online, and I called him up. He's got this great website called BigBookSponsorship.org. I said, I don't know anybody down here. I read your website. I absolutely love it. And I don't know anybody down here that sponsors like you do. You seem to have my similar ideas. He says, yes, you've been touched. He said, let me take you through. And he took me through the steps in 4 days. I had yet to go. In 10 years, I never made it through the steps. You know that? Because I kept relapsing halfway through.
I believe you.
And that's why I get really passionate about the idea that you got to go from, you have to get through them quickly, because people relapse; they can't hold their breath that long.
Right.
So
I don't know if you know this.
I don't know
if you know this. Yeah, let me put this in. I don't know if you know this, but on the rumradio.org website, we have videos and written material to take you through the big book in 24 hours. The section's called 12 and 24, Dr. Bob times 5,000. And that's the written material. It's done by Michael M. out of Chicago. And there's four companion videos that give you the rationale, the sections in the book, the written material, how to do that in 24 hours. Now, you don't have to do it in 24 hours, but all the information necessary to do it is there. And he told me personally, he does oftentimes, he does it within 24 hours, and his success rate goes back to the original, what the big book said, where 50% got it right away, the other 25% later, and the other 25% came in and out, something like that. But that's his experience is that and better because of the timely manner of taking them through the steps. Now, there's the thorough, but I believe the timely. And, you know, you got to remember, originally, when they said thorough, they were going through this in a couple days. They didn't take it a step a month or a step a year.
Right.
Usually, mine, I do the Joe McHugh deal personally. I've never done it Michael's way. I use the Joe McHugh 30 to 45 days. That's two steps a week, and I believe sometimes faster might even be better. And I tell you why, because even if they relapse after going through the steps, and it happens from time to time, most of my guys eventually say it's not up to me, they've made a connection with God. But what happens is once they've gotten all the steps like that, you fill their head with AA, and when you put a belly full of booze in there, they're tormented souls, and they'll always know which way is home.
Yes. Yes.
So,
and it is, you know, it is my experience, my personal experience, and I cannot scientifically, without having to put in this element of God that Bill Wilson was talking about, my experience is I went 10 years trying to make meetings without getting any more than 6 months sober, and with the exception of that dry time of 2 years. And I was absolutely dry, and I was absolutely miserable when I did it. To go from that, to go overnight overnight and within a 4-day span of taking the steps, suddenly not having to yet think about alcohol or drugs again. What happened? And so people want to talk about, oh, you know, I'm the educational variety. Oh, shut up, man. Get to work. You know, this stuff is real. And you go into a meeting and you say, look, do you want to never drink again? Let's not talk about just for a day. Do you never want to drink again? Do you want to get to a point where you are absolutely free from that obsession, where you're not thinking about it? Do you want that? And half the people who've been doing this, you know, the meeting maker way, get violently angry. You know, when you suggest that. You
know? I know.
We don't allow hope in here. What, are you mad?
Who let you in?
Right. So you get tossed out. You know?
Carmen, did you have anything else cooking?
No, actually, no. I'm good. I'm just listening in.
Okay, good. All right, Matthew, did you have something else? So rum radio is your rowdy rum is your passion.
It is, but I joke around that I pulled a Bill Wilson. I actually abdicated the leadership, and there is right now a committee that holds that together. And Mike Chumley is the one who Mike Chumley is the one that actually runs it now, and he's doing a superb, fantastic job. And there are moderators on there such as Elaine B and John Lee and quite a few people who are very, very good at regulating it. And the best thing that I ever did was step down from that position, and it's now just an animal of its own, and I'm very grateful for that.
Giving back. That's what I found keeps me sober. I found is if I'm in the service of my fellow beings, am I not in the service of my God? And when I'm in that service and in that moment, am I not divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity? And in that service and in that moment, is that not when I make my conscious contact with my Creator? That lives from moment to moment, eternity to eternity, life everlasting. The magic words in AA is action and more action. For faith without works is dead.
Absolutely
thank
love that.
So
it's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. It was I hope the folks got some stuff out of that. I did. It was kept me sober for an hour. Harold, do you have any last words?
Well, I really appreciate the views.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think you kind of
can really capture the original spirit of AA, Dr. Bob, and Bill W., and I really appreciate those people for doing that. I'm glad you made it through that 10 years. How many millions of people are out there that have a similar experience, and how many are not out there because their outcome wasn't so good? So I really appreciate all the honesty tonight. I really got a lot of value here. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank
I
you.
Always wonder, Harold, what would have the dead said if they had the opportunity? That would really put a bright light on this thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Carmen, did you have anything you'd like to say? You've been a sweetheart all night.
Oh no, actually, I'm listening in. I've learned a lot. I enjoyed the hour, and I'm going to go into the rum tonight. And I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about in there tonight.
Great. Thanks again, Carmen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having
please
me.
Please remember go on the Facebook, and it's the Rowdy Rum, taking on the most controversial issues in recovery. The Facebook group, the Rowdy Rum.
I enjoy it. That's they support besides supporting Rum Radio. I believe that they're the closest to AA on Facebook. This is real AA. People talking their minds, talking their passions, talking recovery. There's no police force. They just ask you to keep the epithets to a minimum and personal attacks, which is only the veneer of civility. So that's not a lot, folks. if you wanna see what it looks like from the inside, It's the Rowdy Rum on Facebook. You'll enjoy the trip. Well, thanks again, everybody. I'd like to mention that Rum Radio is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,700 towns, cities, and villages, and we're over 250,000 hits to the website and growing mostly by word of mouth. So if you have sponsorship issues and you want to see good format, at least some ideas, tools that you can use and who has enough tools, what a sponsor does, what a sponsor doesn't do, how to find a sponsor, how to find a sponsee, all that stuff we never talk about that keeps the other man sober as well as you. If you think you could change the world, it's either grandiose romanticism or politics. You only change the world one man at a time. And the man is the man that's changed is the sponsor lending himself to be of maximum service to God and your fellows. Well, thanks again, everyone. See you on the radio. Good night. RumRadio.org.
Good night.
Yeah. I didn't mean to.
Did I miss the other place?
Thank you.
break. Count. Supernatural majesty of God, His creative powers. That's how to pray. Became world famous. Dinner is so stressed, and your colleague is awesome. Then you die. What emptiness, you know? Thank you.
You know what? Thank you.